Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 15th day of September. Very nice to have you with us. We'll call it the special lockbox edition. I was going to call it the What Fresh Hell edition, but I think we'll stick with the lockbox edition, at least until we open, we start the fun drive in grand style in just a couple of weeks. Good morning, all. Welcome. I hope you had a beautiful weekend. The weather was very cooperative in most places, and I hope you just had a great time and enjoyed all that early autumn can provide this region, and that it was something calming and soothing and beneficial to all of you. Let me introduce our group to you. We'll get started. We have a fantastic group of panelists this morning. Very proud that they're all together and happy to introduce them to you so we can start. And then I'm gonna do one little thing that I want to do. It's just an experiment that I'm interested in inflicting on all of you. And then we'll get going with the program as it stands. The preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, joins us. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure to have you. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to hear your voice, and I thank you for being here. Jim Ketterer joins us, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Good morning. I just want to say one quick thing at the top. This weekend, I performed at the Jazz at the Lake Festival at Lake George, and it was fantastic, great weather, great crowd. But I want to give a shout out to the people at the Lake George Arts Project who did a fantastic job putting on this festival over 3 days and nights. And, those things don't happen by themselves. They work so hard. And, we're jazz musicians. We're used to being treated really poorly, and they treat you very well. The crowds are great.
Where did you perform in the?
So we on the first night with one trio, I performed. They have something called Around Town. After the main stage ends, everybody disperses, and they have jazz all over town. And performed at a place, a restaurant called Mezzaluna. Also, shout out to them. They treated us very, very well. Even so much so that they had people help us move our equipment in. That's unusual too. And then yesterday morning we performed a different group on the Adirondack boat out on the lake. We were on the jazz cruise.
Oh, how great is that?
It was fantastic. A beautiful day for it. But that's again, fantastic. None of this happens by itself. They work really hard, and they made it work.
So you didn't have to. You didn't have to wash a dish. You didn't have to help row the boat. All this stuff is that they're treating you like the great musicians and artists that you are.
Yeah, we rowed the boat just for fun, but yeah.
Well, it's very nice, and congratulations to all of them. It's a beautiful event, and it, of course, Lake George, any time of year is beautiful, but especially around now, it is, it's a very, very special place to be. We welcome Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council at the Mid-Hudson Valley. Dr. Karen Riedel is here. Hello, Karen. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here. But if I could add on to what Jim was talking about, I'm so jealous of the work that you do. But we have actually, Jim does not just play jazz, but he also gives talks on jazz and diplomacy. And what a fascinating topic this is. And we've actually secured Jim as a speaker for the World Affairs Council's event, an annual event for members. Anyone who's interested in jazz and diplomacy, take a look at what the World Affairs Council does. And maybe you'll join us when Jim talks to our members and supporters in November.
Cool. Yeah.
Thanks, Jim.
Very cool. In November. So we can bring people up to date on that, too. Very nice. Last but certainly not least, we welcome investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman, to the program. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Joe. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm all right. Last week was obviously a tough news week.
Yeah.
But the week almost pleasant, so that was nice.
You know, I have to say, and this is the thing. A long time in this show. We've been doing this show for 25 years, and when we started the show, we did a thing called the poll question of the day. And what we would do at the beginning of the show, we would get headlines from a news editor, and then we would do a thing. We would ask a question. And the question could be anything. The question sometimes was very serious. The question sometimes was very frivolous. And normally what we would try to do is get the public's mood on a particular issue. So it could be something about, what do you think about the firing of the Fed chair, or, you know, dot, 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 something like that. And then people would call in, and we would take calls on the air to talk about that particular issue. I was thinking about that this weekend, because every once in a while, for years and years of thinking about poll questions and coming up with poll questions, I weirdly came up with a poll question this weekend. Now, I realize we don't do them anymore, but I came up with one. Deep in the abscesses of my brain, they used to be recesses, and then over doing 246 shows a year on the topics that we talk about, they've become abscesses, and the bacterial ooze that is there has somewhere in there was a little seed of a thought that I thought would be interesting. Now, stereotypes are horrible things. Stereotypes are not helpful. Stereotypes are demeaning. But I will tell you that as an Irish Catholic from a very large Irish Catholic family, we live up to the stereotype. And so I decided that what I wanted to do, because I knew the answer. I knew the answer, but I wanted to call each of my siblings and ask them this question. If you were the person who was on the roof of the college in Orem, Utah, and you pulled the trigger and you committed the heinous murder, would our parents have turned us in? Overwhelmingly, every one of my brothers said, no, they would not. They certainly would not. They would not do that. In fact, my brother Mike said, no, I think Mom would have had us in Guam before Trump had logged on to Truth Social, which I thought was a good was a good way of looking at it. So then I realized sort of the complexity of the question, because it's not only how you relate, you know, familially and to your parents and the family dynamic, but also even as a parent, how would you react to such a thing? And I've been thinking about this since Friday, and I thought what we would do is I'd ask the question to people. And you can write to us, panel@wamc.org. Now, we're going to be doing two different things here today. One is, if you want to just answer that question, just write to us. And I'm not going to read all of those at all, but we're just going to take a tally, and I'll bring you up to date on sort of where that stands, because I'm fascinated what people think about that. And any story that you would like to tell on top of it, we're more than welcome to. You're more than welcome to share, and we would love to read it. And then we're going to go on with the normal show and talk about what it is that is making news this week and last week and how we're dealing with those issues. You are also free to write your letters as usual for those, and we will go to those in a normal fashion. Panel@WAMC.org in both cases, panel@WAMC.org. Of the four individuals that I have with us for the panel, is there anyone who would like to answer this question?
Well, can I say something related to the to the question? Because I think it's it comes to mind as you raise this. So I saw a post this morning by someone from Yale, someone who I've gotten to know a little bit through my work, Asha Rangappa, former FBI agent. Now she teaches at Yale. And she was talking about the fairly large number of people who have been reported to their employers, reported to governments, what have you, for in one way or another, articulating views about the death of Charlie Kirk that were seen as unseemly and unacceptable.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not taking a position on what's unseemly and what's unacceptable, but she made the point, and I think it's a very important one, that that we're turning into a nation of snitches, and that is a hallmark of a certain kind of regime, and I've seen it myself. And basically, that when you see people who have said something that maybe could definitely be unacceptable, but then that there are specific consequences. They are, number one, reported. That they're reported immediately. Number two, there are consequences. They lose their jobs. We've seen members of Congress say that they should lose federal funds. They should lose businesses. They should perhaps lose their citizenship. There are specific consequences. And then the overall consequence for the body politic is a chilling effect of speech. People know that they might be monitored. People know that they should pull back in one way or another, not just on something that's unseemly or unacceptable, but on something that might be provocative, something that might not be, the standard narrative of the moment. And this this kind of reporting on each other and then consequences to that, that is definitely problematic as it goes on, because, as I've said before in the show, I've lived in places where there are these kinds of regimes, and that is definitely how it works on a daily basis, neighbor to neighbor, family member to family member, people reporting on each other, turned against each other. And anyway, so your poll question brought that to mind.
You know, the other thing I wanted to say about it, and you reminded me that this was something I very much wanted to add to the assignment here, which is, in no way are we judging, in no way are we looking at it and saying one's right, what's wrong. I have no idea. All I'm trying to think of is how people feel about it and look at it if they were put in that position or in looking at their own family situation. Because to me, really to me, I would think it would be the hardest thing in the world.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And your question is about, you know, if someone had committed a crime, would you turn them in? And mine is more like on speech, but it is still the same idea of like,
like, if you committed a crime, I wouldn't care. But if it were my kid, of course I would care, Jim.
Yeah, right. You. I don't even know what to say. It takes a lot to make me speechless. But
we welcome your responses, panel at WAMC.org. Terry, what do you think?
Well, that's a lot to think about. You know, I spend my time in classrooms with young adults trying to encourage them to express themselves on a wide variety of controversial issues, often controversial. And sometimes I think about these things as the leader of conversation in a classroom. Are we approaching a place where students will begin to feel threatened by actually expressing themselves? And therefore, what exactly are we now going to try to achieve in the classroom if we can't really learn how to communicate about anything that's sort of relevant to our lives and controversial? So I think that this topic is very much on anyone's mind who is working in the public domain in any capacity and beginning to feel as if their government is watching them in ways that we just aren't accustomed to in this country. And then if you add the second layer of the actual public watching you and threatening to report you, well, that's certainly something that we're not accustomed to here in this country. So all valid. My parents would have definitely turned me in. It would have been, I'm sure, excruciatingly painful. They would have been really upset. But I was raised to always take responsibility for my actions, to confront them no matter how painful it was. And I'm sure that they would not have let me off the hook for that.
You know, it's the other thing, too, and I just want to make sure that everyone knows what we're talking about. I'm sure you do, but I just want to make sure everyone knows what we're talking about. When we did the show on Friday, when we last met, the news was just coming out as to the arrest was just made. And we learned that the father of the suspect was responsible for informing law enforcement and a local youth minister to help and to have his son turn himself in. So that's where this comes from. It's an actual thing that happened, and that's what I that's what I'm working off of today. Karen, any thoughts?
Yes, I do have some thoughts on that. My son, who's 11, asked me recently whether I would still love him if he became a neo-Nazi. And I said to him, I would still love you just as much, but I wouldn't like you anymore. And it's, I think what we have to also keep in mind in the parent's decision to hitch on him is the alienation they felt with the way he developed over the months leading up to the shooting. And I think that's part of the story. It's like, do they still recognize him as the son they had raised? Personally, would I hand my children in? I don't think so. I would probably send them off to a different country as well, whether or not they align with my political viewpoints.
Yeah, and I think that's what struck me, because I think there are so many factors and so many things that, I mean, it's the way that we're brought up. It's the relationship that we have with our parents, our guardians. It's the relationship that we have with one another. It's how heinous the crime is. Mark.
Joe, before you made it to Guam, my parents would have had me zip-tied. and they would have done it for two reasons. One is their sense of justice was very Aristotelian in terms of ultimately taking responsibility as the way through. And secondly, I also think, particularly in this issue with the death penalty at play, they would have taken it as a risk minimization strategy.
Meaning?
If you're on the lam and you become enemy number one for a few weeks, or even, let's say, go to a different country and it's difficult to get you back, your days at the top of the most wanted list probably don't help your position when you're begging not to be subject to the death penalty at the end of it all. My parents would have probably assessed that very quickly.
Just a couple of letters. Pretty shocked that this is the question, Joe. Regardless of whether it's your kid or not, you turn him in. That you would posit it is a notion of shipping your kid off to escape justice for murder is disturbing. Is this the mindset of WAMC? Obviously not. It is. I'm asking an opinion question, and you are sharing your opinion. So obviously, it's not has anything to do with the mindset of WAMC. I'd be hard pressed to come up with the mindset of WAMC. Anne writes, remember the Unabomber turned in by his family. It's the right thing to do regardless of your politics, and I am against the death penalty. Andrew said, I thought of this the other day. It's been on my mind. There's not a chance. Maybe it's because I was raised in Brooklyn. If he or she goes, I go, says Andrew. Then we check in with this listener who says, I don't even like my siblings, but I certainly wouldn't tie them into law enforcement, much less my child. Then we have this from Jerome, who says, my father was from the Greatest Generation, and he would have no problem taking me directly to the police station because it was the right thing to do. I'm not sure what later generations would do, Generation X, Generation Z's parents. But also remember, this young man mentioned a couple of times about what was done, so it sounded to me like he wanted to be caught, and he also had the support of his pastor. And those are important points. One more, and we're going to go to a break. In these situations, and this is also bringing up the Unabomber. In these situations, I often find myself thinking about the Unabomber's brother and how difficult it must have been for him to tell his mom. And for my own family, dad would call his lawyer first, and I'm not sure what mom would have done, but my brother would have gleefully ratted out me in a hot minute. So there you go. We'll take a break. We'll go to other topics, and we'll talk more. You can keep on writing us about this, and we'll check in every once in a while and read some of the responses as we sort of resurrect the poll question in an abridged form this morning. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And if you just want to talk to us about regular stuff that we are discussing this morning, use that same address. We'll be able to figure out the two. Panel at WAMC.org. Don't forget that lockbox. It needs your help as well. Panel at WAMC.org for that. WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. It's 52 minutes past 9 o'clock on this 15th day of September. It's also lockbox time, and we'll be going over to Sarah and Ray in just a bit as they help and continue to try to fill the lockbox and do what we can to continue the funding for this great radio station. We want to go to other topics, although we're not going to go far from what we were discussing this morning, and that has to do, we'll begin with the issue of leftist ideology. This from the governor of Utah, Spencer Cox, who I was just amazing. I'm not making any judgment here about Governor Cox. I will say, he was on every show this weekend. I don't know how he did it, but man. Utah Governor Spencer Cox said authorities are speaking with suspect Tyler Robinson's family and his romantic partner as they investigate Charlie Kirk's killing. We do know from reporting over the weekend that that the young man, Tyler Robinson, has refused to speak with, to help in any way in this investigation. And to speak out. Governor Cox said Sunday that authorities still do not know the motive in the deadly shootings of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, but that interviews with those close to suspect Tyler Robinson have revealed new information, including that he has a leftist ideology. And that's sort of what I would like to talk about this morning, of exactly what that is and where that brings us in the many questions that come up as a result of what happened. Robinson, who was arrested after a 33-hour manhunt, has not confessed to authorities or cooperated with the investigation since he was taken into custody Thursday. The governor made multiple appearances on television networks. Relatives told investigators that Robinson had, quote, very different political views from those of his conservative family. That is what Cox said on NBC's Meet the Press. There was clearly a leftist ideology without providing further details. State voter records show Robinson is registered as an unaffiliated voter while his parents are registered Republicans. Cox said the suspect, who had was once a straight-A student, appeared to have been radicalized after dropping out of Utah State University. Bullet casings recovered at the scene of the shooting were engraved with messages such as, "Hey, fascist, catch," and words and symbols used in gaming culture. Friends have confirmed that there was kind of that deep, dark internet, the Reddit culture, and these other dark places of the internet where this person was going deep, according to Governor Cox. Jim Ketterer.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, Governor Cox has definitely been consistently good in saying that people ought to not engage in speech and in behavior, for sure, that is going to further inflame the situation. And we can wish that there were more people in leadership positions who were doing this, including at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But he has been consistently good in that regard. But I was really stunned amidst all of that good stuff that when the arrest first happened, he also said, you know, I had prayed for 33 hours that this would be someone who was basically an other, that they wouldn't be from among us, that they would be out of the state. And, you know, it seemed to me as I was listening to it in real time, the implication was that not only would they not be from Utah, but, you know, they wouldn't be part of how he is conceiving of the inside society. And this is this is problematic. And I think that what he said further on now about this leftist ideology business seems to be drawing from that strain of what he said. And I would just say to Governor Cox, please double down on taking your own very good advice, because I heard another quote, and I missed the name of who it was, from a Republican member of Congress who said, you know, I think we can all agree on radical. He said, I think we should just drop the leftist and rightist part of it and try to deal with radicalism as it is being fomented in our society. And I think that's exactly the way to go, because it seems to be parroting the use of the word leftist is definitely parroting what is coming from the White House. And we've heard the not just on this issue, but the president has talked about, you know, leftist lunatics, radical lunatics, terrorists, all of these sorts of things that have the exact opposite effect. And I think it's not very helpful. In addition to the fact, so how was this young man radicalized, and what does that really mean? And is it really leftist or not? There was no evidence of any of this that was proposed. And so I think, again, he needs to take a step back and listen to his own good advice about not inflaming the situation and not getting out in front of this case that's going to be now going through the judicial system.
Karen Riedel.
Yeah, I'm actually, Jim, thank you very much for what you said, but I take issue, or I see it somewhat differently. When Cox talked about his desperation when he realized that Schroeder was a member of the community, I embrace that. I appreciated that, because by acknowledging, he seemed to be devastated that he was a member of the community, because it means he's one of us, and that invites us to find the root cause in the radicalization of the people on the left and the right. And I see radicalization among my students on the left and the right. It's not just young people, but the issue is clearly online, and an open space. The acknowledgement that this is one of us, this is a member of our community, open space for policy debates on what we really need. But otherwise, I fully agree with you. We need to move away from this notion that the left or the right is radicalized. There are individuals who are radicalized, and we need to dig deeper into what radicalizes them. What we hear from our leaders, however, is a differentiation between radicals on the right. President Trump on Fox and Friends said the radicals on the right are radical because they don't want to see crime. The radicals on the left are the problem. And this is the definition of radicals on the left. They are vicious and horrible and politically savvy. They want men in women's sports. They want transgender people. They want open borders. The worst thing that has happened to this country. And that, of course, is problematic at this time. Now, we don't know what the actual motives were. The engravings may just be simply a reflection of Robinson's addiction to online gaming. But what is very clear to me is that his actions are deeply at odds with left-leaning ideology that focuses, among other things, on gun control and the reduction of gun violence. So the actions clearly have nothing to do with liberal ideology.
We'll pause there for a moment. We're going to go over to get to do some business, and then also go to Lockbox Central with Ray and Sarah. We'll come back. We'll hear from both Terry and Mark. We welcome your letters, panel at wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Thanks to Sarah and Ray for their great work and really telling you about the lockbox and the importance of it. You can keep the donations coming in at wamc.org. Panel at wamc.org is where you can write to us on the issues that we are talking about this morning, and we welcome you to do just that. We have been talking this morning about the shooting of Charlie Kirk and the fact that the governor of the state of Utah has said that the suspect had a leftist ideology, although the motive remains unclear. We have had both Karen Riedel and Jim Ketterer speak about that. Jim, you wanted to add something real quick to what Karen had said.
Yeah, I mean, I, as always, agree with Karen and her insights. The only thing I would say, not in disagreement, but just kind of in addition maybe, is Karen was talking about Governor Cox being upset about this being a member of the community. And my concern is, how does Governor Cox imagine the community that he represents? And what if this had been, for instance, a Muslim who lives in Utah and is an American citizen? Would that person be considered a member of the community, or would they be an other? Oh, and that's just one example. And so that's really my concern.
Terry Gibson.
Well, it's a complicated question, and I personally think that Governor Cox has really missed an opportunity to be that leader that we need. What we really need in this country right now is a strong leader that has access to a big microphone, which he currently does due to these circumstances, unfortunately. And we need that person, whoever they might be, wherever they are, to speak to the American public in a way that doesn't create division, but creates unity. And I think much of what he has said has been an attempt to create unity, and that's been acknowledged already by others on the program today. But I think when you say things like leftist ideology, it just really damages all the effort that you have made and all the sincere efforts you may have. And you begin to label a particular group or a particular language in a certain way, certainly without really clear evidence. And I think you're really just working against the whole effort to unify. Whether you say communist or Marxist or socialist or leftist, to a large demographic in this country, all those words mean exactly the same thing, and they all have an extremely negative, radical connotation. And so this labeling of different groups in different ways is not helpful on either side, the Democratic side or the Republican side, the conservative side, the liberal side. It's not helpful in bringing that kind of unity, certainly when that language is coming from someone who is trying to position themselves as being a leader. I think it's been a really long time in the history of this country, regardless of who was president, regardless of the politics, that we haven't had a leader of that nature in public. Even the past presidents, I think, no matter how much you might hate them or like them, there would come a time where you could see that at their core, they were really interested in trying to find a way to bring unity, and they were aware that certain language, certain words would not be helpful to that effort. And so they did try to avoid them. But those days are now gone. And we are left with a leader that clearly wants to divide us at the federal level in the White House. And no one else has been able to sort of rise up and equal that and confront that with more civil language. And I was hoping that Governor Cox could maybe be that person. I think he's missed the moment.
I mean, the other thing, too, we haven't mentioned this, and so I don't want it to go under the surface in case anyone missed it. I doubt you did. But the fact that Cox also confirmed that Robinson's live-in romantic partner was transgender, that individual was cooperating with the investigation. But I do wonder, to your point, Jim, of, again, would that individual be part of Governor Cox's idea of what our community is and within yeah. that and the othering of the LGBTQIA plus community. Mark.
Joe, this whole thing just ripped at me. And having it happen on 9/11, I was there on 9/11 in the World Trade Center. I couldn't decide why I felt so badly. But one of the reasons I feel badly is because we as a nation have historically and are being suckered by this issue of what were his politics, or even if he was quote-unquote radical. I don't care. What matters is why he decided – to use violence. That's it. His shoe size, his hair color, his beliefs, his partner. And that's what leaders need to focus on. And there's a reason they're not. And it's going to be to our detriment. It has historically been to our detriment. And it will continue to be to our detriment. And it's particularly fraught when Donald Trump is in the White House. Because as we've heard him say, he wants to, I mean, he is using classic, when I heard his speech, it is classic double speech. It is out of 1984, where he talks about political violence as if he himself had not effectively called for it, right? I mean, what do you mean you're condemning political violence? But of course, then he turns to it as leftist political violence, because his argument doesn't work unless he puts that adjective in front of it. And it's got the danger associated with it, because he said those responsible, implying that there are multiple people, right, and he's going to go search for them. And historically, this country has been burdened by the fact that if something can be seen as political, we take it differently. And I'll give you a great example. We have read, anyone who's read any article recently about political, quote-unquote, political violence in this country, sees the list from the 60s. But the list from the 60s doesn't include Fred Hampton. It never includes Malcolm X. Why? Because their politics were not seen as left-right. The Malcolm X execution was an inter-party squabble full of politics, but within the Nation of Islam itself. But we as a country dismissed that as relevant to our politics then and even now, because we use, because what we focus on is the quote-unquote politics. We as a nation, and by the way, we have no idea what this guy's motivations are. My understanding is the reports around Trump, the person who shot at Trump, was that he had also considered trying to assassinate Biden as well. So first of all, we ought to stop it with this guy and just give it a 2-week pause and wait. But while we're waiting, we ought to, or however many weeks it takes for them to really understand this, but while we're waiting, we ought to understand what's historically been done to us and what is being done to us. And we, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, we're all willing participants in this nonsense, and we should just take a breath and let it stop. It is not relevant what his politics were. It is relevant why he went from deciding that he was going to use violence to impose his will on this on others. That's what matters. That's it.
I was struck. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to follow up on that too, because it just points like a laser beam that the media, especially the corporate media, has to take enormous amount of responsibility in how they are framing the story, because much of that framing is just reinforcing the negative terminology that's being used by the White House and by Governor Cox and by other activists on the left and the right that just create even more division. And it's sad to see that this killing and the death of a young man has become just red meat for the media, and they're going to frame it any way they can to make sure they keep their subscribers, their listeners tuned to it so that they can sell advertising and continue to make a profit. And it's kind of disgusting, really, when you really think about what's going on and how we are really very much just being led by narratives in the media in ways that are just unbelievably strong and almost addicting to the American public. And we've got to find a way to break free from it. And if we don't, it's kind of terrifying to think about where we're going to go.
And by the way, the left fell into it as well, with this almost schadenfreude in some cases about quoting some of Charlie Kirk's remarks and saying that they were somehow relevant to what happened to him. I mean, so this, we're all, I mean, I don't, nobody on either side of this, but let's figure out where we need to draw the line. We're drawing it at the wrong place, and we're letting them draw it for us, and it's regrettable.
You know, I was struck too by, sometimes you read something and you're like, whoa, really? Okay. Louisiana Congressman Clay Higgins spoke this weekend and is vowing to take action against social media users who mocked or belittled the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Higgins called Kirk a beautiful young man who dedicated his whole life to delivering respectful conservative truth into the hearts of liberal enclave universities. I'm going to use the congressional authority and every influence with big tech platforms to mandate immediate ban for life of every post or commenter that belittled the assassination of Charlie Kirk, Higgins wrote. He went on to say that he will push for users to be banned from all platforms forever if they celebrated Kirk's killing. He also said he would seek to have businesses blacklisted aggressively and license revoked.
This is what I was talking about before. This idea that speech, in some cases unpleasant and unseemly speech, would be targeted for political reasons, there would be political consequences, and that the institutions of the government would be used to create those long-standing consequences. I don't know if it was Higgins or somebody else who was also saying that anybody who even approached anything that was problematic with regard to the Kirk assassination, if they were an international student, would have their visa revoked.
Correct.
Immediately. And on and on and on. And so, you know, I would just recommend a movie to people. Just don't take it from me. There's a great movie, not a documentary, but a drama called The Lives of Others, about how this really operated in East Berlin and how this kind of snitching and monitoring and consequences and the chilling effect of it has this incremental effect over time. There's not one moment where people say, like, okay, well, right now we have entered into an authoritarian regime. It happens while your lives are going on seemingly normally otherwise, but this, from a sitting member of Congress saying this kind of thing, it's absolutely outrageous and chilling. So check out The Lives of Others, and I think you'll get a sense of how it really worked.
But it's demonstrably, it's doublespeak. It's demonstrably ill-considered, because if we said to them, well, that's fine, let's, by the way, obviously, if private markets want to do what he's talking about, have at it. Government has no point in that, in part in that. It's in the Constitution. And why not? Well, because if we said that all people who use social media to lionize those who were involved in J6 and the proximate cause of the deaths of law enforcement should be removed from social media, he'd be asking for Trump to be banned in that case. Right? I mean, so again, don't fall for it. It is not relevant what these people thought, what their politics were. It is relevant why they decided to use violence. That's where they went wrong. Not in speech, not in thought, not in partners, not in shoe size, not in hair color. And we've let the media for a week or almost a week now lead us around by the nose on this. And it's just, it drives me batty, but we should be smarter.
Laura writes and says, holy cow, Marjorie Taylor Greene belittled David Hogg, a child who survived a mass shooting after Sandy Hook. She lied and said it never happened. It was an FBI false flag operation. The grieving parents were doxxed, threatened, and some had to move. But no one is allowed to say bad things about the Kirk killing. That from Laura. Anybody else on this before we...
David Hogg was in Florida, right? Not
Parkland.
Sandy Hook.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
It was Marjorie Stoneham Burnham.
Right, yeah.
Whatever those three words
in a correct order.
But
yeah.
You're correct, yes. Go ahead.
Go ahead, me?
Yes.
I think we really need to differentiate between talking, like making fun of his murder and criticizing the messages that Charlie Kirk spread and the methods he used to spread the messages. He's in the last few days, we were reminded of the contributions that Kirk has made to our democratic society by reaching out to young people, by spreading his messages. And that gives young people the choice, and all of us the choice, to weigh in on it and to disagree. But Kirk's organization also took steps that were highly problematic. For example, the watch list of left-leaning professors and many people's lives have been ruined as a result of that. And so while I personally also take issue with making fun or celebrating his death, which there certainly is nothing to celebrate for, not for his family, not for, for the community that, that had to witness the atrocities, and for society that's further driven apart. But my issue here is with inability to examine the work, Kurt's work in the past, and how that work has contributed to where we ended up.
We're going to take a break. We're going to go over to Lockbox Central and hear from Ray Graff and Sarah LaDuke about the importance of supporting our Lockbox and keeping this radio station alive so we can have discussions exactly like the one we are having this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, if you would like to share your thoughts with us in the time we have left. In the meantime, you can get the ball rolling and help with the Lockbox at WAMC.org. RG. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We've got about 15 minutes left with our group, and we'll try to get to as many topics as we can. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Terry Gibson is with us, Jim Ketterer, Karen Riedel, and Mark Whitman, and we do welcome you. Let's move on to other things. So we talked a lot about last week, for the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about the various crackdowns and crime crackdowns in our nation's cities, and the fact of going into Washington and the National Guard and troops being brought into the District of Columbia, as well as other cities. And it was brought to light over the weekend after so many people, especially Democrats, were saying, well, look, you're going into these blue cities, and you're doing this, but you look at the largest crime rate, it is Memphis, Tennessee, and that is a blue, that is a blue city in a red state. So lo and behold, then this weekend it was announced that they were going to go into Memphis next. And then the word about Chicago was kind of quieted over the last couple of days, so it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Meanwhile, in D.C., this story from the Washington Post. On President Donald Trump's orders, thousands of local police, federal agents, and camouflage-clad troops have fanned out across the nation's capital every night for the past month. The surge sprawled across D.C. from its poorest pockets to its busiest commercial corridors and marbled monuments. The White House has touted the success of the operation, saying it drove down crime and took illegal guns off the streets. But they've offered little insight into who was being arrested, how they were arrested, where they were arrested, and what they were arrested for. To answer those questions, the Washington Post gathered more than 1,000 charging documents from local and federal courts, mapped the incidents and examined how they played out. The documents portray an expanded law enforcement presence that considered no crime too small while hunting for guns and employing tactics that have sparked community opposition in the past. More than a third of the 1,273 arrests examined by the Post from the first 4 weeks of the Trump crackdown involved federal law enforcement, a figure that doesn't include arrests made by immigration officials. Those arrests occurred in all 8 city wards, but were concentrated in the city's poorest, least white, and most crime-ridden neighborhoods. Additionally, many occurred in low-crime areas, highly visible to the president and tourists, like the National Mall outside the White House and around Union Station. D.C. arrests from August 7th to September 4th. The numbers are of the 470 arrests where federal officers were present. Weapons charges were the most common, primarily illegal gun possession. 1 in 4 cases involved gun charges. Officers found firearms in cars, waistbands, and a child's backpack. 1 in 7 cases involved people accused of having open containers of alcohol. almost two dozen cases involve public consumption of marijuana, and one in eight cases involve people accused of assaulting a police officer or resisting arrest. Most of those also involved other charges, but on 20 occasions, assaulting or resisting was the sole charge, including people who had screamed at, spat on, and or, in one viral case, hurled a Subway sandwich at the federal officer. Mark.
You know, Joe, I read this and I thought, oh, we're going to get some proof that this whole crackdown on crime is a farce. And I read it and I took away the fact that more law enforcement presence in a city that's got too much crime seems to yield some results. Now, we can argue about exactly where these arrests took place, and certainly some of the minor charges aren't earth-shattering in themselves, but I've certainly witnessed firsthand issues where somebody who was up to no good was tagged with a minor offense intentionally to further public safety. So my takeaway is, gee, what a surprise. More law enforcement leads to, say, the removal of more guns off the street, which is a good thing, but that doesn't mean the way Trump's doing it is the way it should be done, unfortunately. We need a systematic long-term approach to fighting crime anywhere we feel it's too high. Trump's not doing that. This is Trump for dummies. Find a big problem, hyperbolize it, make a big deal, look for a little bit of improvement, and claim success. The other thing he's doing, by the way, is he's taking it out, the sort of the switchback between enforcing immigration and enforcing law generally has allowed him in blue states to sort of show what he's doing and gin up support amongst his base, whereas in red states, the immigration officials are going into courts and other places. They're just not doing it with any opposition, so it doesn't make the news, and it's quiet. And again, that works to his benefit because he's allowed to embarrass blue states and get the press that he wants, whereas he gets simply the enforcement without the embarrassment more often in red states. So I took it away as, gee, it seems like this is sort of working, but it's the wrong long-term approach.
Terry Gibson.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a big difference in trying to rely on traditional law enforcement to enforce laws and hold people accountable for breaking those laws, hold people accountable for illegal behavior. There's a big difference in doing that and sending in the National Guard in camouflage, running down your streets with automatic rifles, wearing masks, and terrifying everyone. And, you know, it's, you know, nothing says, hey, I want to be a unifier more than sending out, you know, the military into the streets. Again, it's just it's a counterproductive form of communication. It's a counterproductive form of leadership. It's also, I think, ironic that the administration that refuses to take the lead on doing anything about passing laws and legislation to help curb gun violence, to help restrict access to guns, has to resort to sending the military in the streets with guns to try to take guns away from people. I mean, that tells you that the situation truly is out of control. And, you know, I think we're probably in the slim minority of people that are actually reading the details and even maybe care about the numbers. This administration certainly does not care about the details or the numbers. Whatever the details and numbers need to be, they're going to say that on any given day. They're going to make up numbers. I'm not even sure I trust these numbers that we're getting. And it's more about just the public relations aspect of showing again and again and again his loyal base that I'm willing to take whatever steps I need to be the leader that you want me to be, and regardless of what kind of division or pain or suffering it brings to anyone else. And clearly there is if we are to believe these numbers, then there is clearly a certain amount of racial profiling going on here, which again is not only illegal, but not helpful to any type of unification effort in this country.
Dr. Karen Riedel.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. This doesn't solve the or even address the root causes of crime. Racial profiling, of course, the Supreme Court seems to have a different view on that now, but that's very clear in the numbers that is happening and deeply concerning. But, you know, a question that I have, and I didn't see the answer to that, is where are the homeless in this? Because when this was first announced, The federal troops would be sent to D.C. One of the groups that was going to be targeted were the homeless. And we took here on the show issue with the fact that the homeless were lumped in with crime. And I don't see whether the homeless here are incorporated into the numbers.
It's a good point. I mean, this has come into sort of a three-pronged operation of both the homeless, the aforementioned, the said, the crime aspect, and then, of course, immigration as well. So all of those coming together. Jim?
I agree with so much of what my colleagues have already said, so I won't repeat it. I would just highlight the fact that, you know, the District of Columbia is a different case than any of the other cities that might be subject to having Donald Trump send federal forces. And I'll talk in a second about the various forces. And so we can see in D.C., because it is a federal district, that it is easier to do this from the White House perspective. Also, there are a lot of law enforcement agencies that are involved there that are different than the National Guard and other troops. Troops are not trained or otherwise set up to be dealing with law enforcement, first off. It's just not effective to be doing that. And so where it has been effective, as Mark has been talking about, has been other agencies of federal law enforcement who appear to be working in cooperation with the District of Columbia Police Department. And so if the White House were really serious about addressing crime, they'd be doing all the other things that my colleagues have talked about. I don't think we should just skip over the fact, too, if we're talking about the continued use of troops who are in the federal control of the White House but are basically part of our combat forces, that this is in violation of the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act. You know, it is very clear that the military is not allowed to be used for law enforcement for domestic purposes except in a few very rare cases. And in those cases, there really has to be an emergency. And just saying there's an emergency from the White House does not make it an emergency. You know, there used to be a time when conservatives supported the rule of law, the Constitution, and things like that. And this is in clear violation of the rule of law. And that's no minor thing.
We're going to leave it there for this Monday morning. My thanks to everyone who was a part of our discussion and to all of you who were joining us this morning. We are going to continue and then in a little bit go back to Lockbox Central. My thanks to Dr. Karen Riedel, Terry Gibson, Jim Ketterer, and Mark Whitman. Thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you all here. Thank you. You are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.